from the Sky News Centre at 6. A woman and her daughter, who were part of Britain's first all-female Islamic State terror cell, have been jailed. 22-year-old Rizlan Bula and her mum, Mina Deesh, have been given a total of 22 years behind bars. They planned a knife attack on Westminster along with Bula's sister, Safa, who will be sentenced at a later date. Dean Hayden's the UK's anti-terror policing lead.
Certainly one of the younger daughters in communication with a Daesh fighter in Syria and on various mobile devices, a vast array of extremist material.
Plans to criminalise people who take photos up someone's dress have been blocked by a single MP. A bill on so-called upskirting in England and Wales has temporarily been halted by Tory Sir Christopher Chope, who was objecting to the parliamentary process. EastEnders star Leslie Grantham has died at the age of 71. He was Dirty Den in the soap in the 1980s. Two teenage moped riders have been jailed for life for stabbing a man to death as they stole his iPhone. The pair went on a violent robbing spree in West London in October. In sport, it's a big one. Portugal against Spain at the World Cup this evening. Jay Townsend reports from a tapas bar in St. Petersburg.
This was already a massive game, but it's Fernando Hierro's first as Spain boss, just 2 days into the role.
I think it's not good for the team.
A last-minute coaching change does have some effect.
Hierro's in charge after Julen Lopetegui was sacked for agreeing to join Real Madrid once the tournament's over. Portugal boss Fernando Santo couldn't care less about all the Spanish drama.
The manager on Spain's bench will be Fernando Hierro. I don't expect any surprises.
Spain and Portugal last met at Euro 2012. Hopefully it's better than that drab 0-0.
Elsewhere, Iran have their first World Cup win since 1998 after a 1-0 victory over Morocco. They won it with a stoppage time own goal. That's the latest. I'm Annie Green.
Stand by.
Check this out.
Are you ready for the music?
Solid dance beats every Saturday night. The Touch, Deli G, BCFM 93.2.
Is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's World Cup Free Politics Show. I say that, but we will be discussing it a little bit later on. But before we begin this evening's show, I'd like to read out the press statement from the Treasury about special measures being taken by Her Majesty's Government this evening relating to the UK banking sector, British tax havens and social security payments. The statement reads as follows. From 6 p.m. this evening, all transactions in and out of the UK and all Crown dependencies, including the Isle of Man, Channel Islands and Cayman Islands, will be prohibited and accounts have been frozen. When banks and markets open next Wednesday, that's the 20th of June 2018, a new maximum transfer amount of £1,000 per account per week will come into force. No new accounts will be allowed to open. Where the payment of wages is affected by these limits, account holders will need to apply to Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs for permission to close offshore accounts and transfer all funds to a UK account on the payment of 50% exchange control tax, a new tax. Banking licences will be withdrawn at midnight tonight from all London's merchant banks, as well as RBS, Ulster Bank, Clydesdale Bank, NatWest, HSBC, Lloyds, Barclays and their subsidiaries, which manage 92% of the current accounts in the UK, pending appointment of new Treasury-nominated directors and executives to those banks. The National Audit Office will replace the auditing role of KPMG, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Ernst & Young and Deloitte as UK core bank auditors. Individual banking licences will not be reinstated at 1 a.m. on Monday morning unless all of these new directives and directors and executives as well as the National Audit Office are legally in place at each bank. Link operated cash machines will be inoperative from midnight tonight and electronic or card payments have been disabled from 6 p.m. This means the entire UK banking system, apart from cash, will be effectively disabled for 48 hours from midnight tonight. In addition, other measures are being taken this weekend through statutory instruments, emergency legislation on Monday and letters from Buckingham Palace and Downing Street to do the following. First, to request Commonwealth governments adopt similar measures to seize deposits and close tax havens. Second, to close the London Stock Exchange on Monday and Tuesday. Third, to nationalise all UK cash vault delivery and collection services, link cash points and the UK office of the SWIFT payment system, all three with Treasury appointed boards. Fourth, to immediately transfer all customs and border officers to port and airport duties with the support of trained sniffer dogs from the prison service and elsewhere to enforce the new exchange control measures. Fifth, all social security welfare claimants will have the weekly income to which they are entitled restored, with new weekly minimum of £100, and all reviews and all benefit sanctions cancelled forthwith. It has been decided the liquidity and good standing of the United Kingdom can only be maintained if the wealth now deposited in UK-controlled tax havens is first secured and then taxed at a rate of no less than 50%, and that the rise in destitution and begging is reversed. In measures to be introduced next month, depositors will be able to move deposits abroad from Crown dependencies and the UK, but only by paying this new 90% exchange control tax. Her Majesty's government has decided to implement this new annual high rate of tax, that of 50% initially, then 25% on the 1st of April every year thereafter, because of the many years which these deposits have remained untaxed. These measures will be followed soon by an unprecedented public sector spending programme, building of public works and infrastructure, including good quality public housing. This statement has been approved and signed by Her Majesty's Secretaries of State, the Prime Minister and Chancellor of the Exchequer, dated Friday the 15th of June 2018. God save the Queen. Well, did that lift your spirits or put the fear of God into you? That was our fictional scenario of what a future reimposition of exchange controls and banking regulation could look like. The problem being, too many rich and powerful tax avoiders, including the Queen and the newspaper barons, might never allow it. Just a bit of fun. But one day it could happen, and we ought to be ready if it does. A kind of plan B. The failure to act could lead to catastrophic crash that Martin Summers has been warning of for over a decade now. So I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's real news is Lib Dem councillor for Redland, Fee Hance. And
Lib Dem? I don't think so, my friend.
Sorry.
Green.
Councillor for, Redland, Fee Hance. And old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. So quite a lot of fake news so far on this show today. But I'll ask you maybe first, Martin, what you make of this idea of getting hold of the money that's in tax havens and taxing it, because for so many years it's been sitting there, and the British are being finger is being pointed not only by the rest of the world but also by people like the Tax Justice Network, saying actually it's British Crown dependencies that hold most of this untaxed cash.
Well, it's true, but they're not the only ones. I mean, there's Luxembourg, the state of Nevada in the US has also become a major tax haven.
The Swiss,
yeah. And I'm afraid that the kind of measures that you've suggested, and I believe you've been speaking to Steve Keen about what measures might be appropriate, who's an economist of note at Kingston University, then that sort of thing will only happen if you've had a crash, sadly. Because that's when people suddenly realise that they needed to have done something. But of course, it's a stable horn that bolted.
Is it simply because the people in power are the people with their savings in cash havens?
Well, exactly. I mean, a crash may come about in a relatively predictable way, because everybody can see it coming, or it may happen by accident. If it comes about in a predictable way, the wealthy will have already moved their money where it needs to be to avoid being sequestered. And of course, most of the wealth that's been accumulated in the last 10 years is not because they've invented a better widget, it's because of quantitative easing, which has artificially increased asset prices. In other words, the asset-owning classes in Britain and elsewhere have been bailed out by the taxpayer. The market solution was to allow the crash to happen in 2008, which means a lot of rich people lose all their money and have to go down the job centre. That didn't happen. But most people don't realise that the allocation of resources beyond that point is no longer a market allocation of resources. It just depends on, if you've got assets, asset prices have been goosed by public intervention, which of course isn't in the free market textbook, but that's what they've been doing. But the implication of that in the long run is that money isn't their money, it's our money, and we've got every right to take it back from them.
I mean, there's a Goldman Sachs whistleblower out there who's been saying, well, all this asset transfer, basically it's quantitative easing money, is going to these businesses, many of these businesses, but what they're doing is using it for is to actually buy their own shares. Yeah. Rather than actually pay employees more or employ more people, they're using it to buy their own shares up, to artificially bump up their share price.
Yeah, well, this buyback mania has gone completely completely bonkers. I mean, it used to be if a company had a large cash stash that it had managed to accumulate through genuine trading, they could use it to buy their own shares as a means of, you know, propping up their share price. But what they're actually doing now is that the you've got basically what's like a control fraud. People are borrowing money. The heads of these companies are borrowing money to buy the shares. Which then pushes the share price up, and most of these people have got share options, so they're making a killing on that. And then when the company goes bust, they'll be long gone with the money. So they're all doing it, because if you don't do it, you're a fool, because everybody else is doing it, which is why we've got the biggest financial bubble in history, which will burst at some point.
I mean, we've also got a problem, haven't we? As companies go bust, like Carillion, the people at the centre of that company, that is to say the directors, the financial director and the chief executive, or the executives on that company, they know that the company's going down. And so they then start to take as much as they can from the company before it finally becomes public that it's no longer viable.
Yeah, well, what you do is you borrow money to pump up your share price. You then because you own quite a few shares, you make a killing on that, and then you stag the shares, you sell them immediately and walk away. Which means you walk away with the cash. You know, basically, it's looting.
Is that a crime?
No, it isn't, because everybody's doing it. It used to be controlled, but it's not anymore.
Insider dealing, isn't that?
Well, insider dealing is supposedly criminal, but it actually goes on all the time. If you think about what happened in the missile attack on Syria the other week. You know, that Mrs. May's husband lies in bed with her every night, and basically he knew that the attack was going to happen and when it was going to happen, and he was able to tell his chums to move, you know, to bet appropriately, and therefore a killing was made. And if you are at the level of making decisions about things, when to bomb and who to bomb, and your husband is also a top trader, then your husband, and you can't imagine that they actually lie in bed and don't talk about it. Of course they do, and of course he goes to work next day and makes a killing on the back of it. Is that insider trading? Yes, it is.
Well, on tax havens, there's an estimated £100 billion lost annually because of the £30 trillion which is stashed in tax havens, the majority of which is in Britain and British Crown dependencies. And we're going to hear for a minute from the author, some ideas anyway, from the author of Debunking Economics, Steve Keen. He's, as Martin said, he's a professor down at Kingston University. But Fee, what do you make of this idea of any kind of attempt to put up exchange controls to stop money? I mean, we're in the situation now, aren't we, where money goes wherever it's cheapest to keep it. And that for quite a long time has been Britain. So in a way, there's an opportunity there to grab that before it disappears.
Well, I mean, it'll astonish you to learn that I'm neither an economist nor a tax expert. But what strikes me is that I think a lot of people are quite confused why it's perfectly legal to avoid tax and pay someone to help you avoid tax, but not to evade it. And there's an awful lot of people legally not paying the tax they should be, and lots of people illegally not paying the tax they should do. And it seems that they're treated in different ways. And one lot of tax evasion is completely respectable, and it's part of the establishment, and everybody does it if you're from a certain background. And if the government was serious about raising funds, they would do something about it rather than penalise people at the bottom of the pile. Things like universal credit, which we'll come on to later, but which is actually losing money hand over fist and has saved absolutely nothing.
Well, let's talk about that right now, actually, because there's a report out today from the National Audit Office about universal credit. Martin, we've been talking about universal credit for a long time on here and heard some pretty horrific horror stories about it. The main problem, so far as I can see, or one of the most recent things I've come across, is the complete change that there'll be to housing benefits. So you can be sanctioned whilst on housing benefit in a similar way to people are being sanctioned now. In other words, you could, feasibly within a month, just lose your home. Whereas the situation with housing benefit is, if the city council here decides that they think that someone shouldn't be entitled to the housing benefit, you have a long process over a couple of months by which you can prove, yes, actually, I'm entitled. What they'll be able to do in future is simply to cut it off literally just like that.
Well, yeah, and of course, the wait to claim, you've got to wait 6 weeks or now 5 weeks before you can get any money. I mean, the old system was geared on the idea that you wanted to keep people in their houses. They may have lost their job or become sick or some other misfortune, and at that point you want to keep them housed so that they can get themselves sorted out. But the design of universal credit means that people immediately fall into rent arrears, and the other problem is that they won't pay directly to the landlords, so the private landlords won't rent to people on universal credit and evict people if they are on it. So that's why they've had 6 years to roll it out and have not been able to roll it out, because everywhere they do roll it out, it immediately leads to rent arrears, evictions, and it's the main cause of the increase of measured homelessness that we've seen. But the government won't change course on this, even though, you know, they could easily change these basic administrative features of the system, because they want it to be punitive, and that's what the whole idea of it was to make poor people suffer, and that's what they wanted it to do, and that's what it does do.
Fee, just on the BBC are saying today that universal credit, and they're looking at this report that's come out, could actually cost more than the current benefit system.
Well, yeah. Surprise, surprise. I mean, I think, in fairness, there's been problems with paying housing benefit directly to landlords for some time. That's a policy that was put in a while back. And even under the old system, if your tax credits were changed by as much as 10p, then all of your benefits would be suspended whilst they were reassessed. I mean, nice to come across people all the time, but this happened to. I think the big thing with universal credits is the delays that people are undergoing. I mean, something like 25% of people have had excessive delays on that. And, you know, not many people can survive that kind of hiatus in their finance.
Isn't this sort of dog whistle? Delays. The dog whistle here is, look, we don't care who you are or if you're entitled to benefits, go and get a job.
Yes, it's meant to be financially encouraging people to find work, isn't it? I mean, I don't know what that means, but frankly, if you're struggling to pay the rent and to put food on the table, you're not going to be out there filling out massive 20-page application forms. Applying for jobs takes time, and you need to be in a decent frame of mind, and a lot of people need a lot of support to get through application forms. God knows, I've been filling a few in myself of late, and I feel their pain. Yeah. And it's not as simple as that. And if you have children, especially benefits for women with single mothers with children have been cut, so they can't claim full benefits past the age of, I think it's 5 now. I mean, you try having any kind of job that you can support yourself on if you've got a couple of kids in primary school.
But the system after the Second World War was designed to help people who were unemployed for short periods of time. And right up until the 1970s, we had full employment. So the benefit system has been getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Somehow, at some point, they're going to have to say, well, that's enough.
I think there was definitely a case for reviewing the benefit system. Oh, yes. But what they've replaced it with is something which, as you say, is very punitive and aimed at punishing people for being poor. And to boot, I mean, as I think I've mentioned last time I was here, the really wicked lie about all of this is it's saving no money at all. Rolled out under the premise that, oh, we're saving money and, you know, punishing the undeserving poor. It's all quite Dickensian. Punishing the undeserving poor and giving a leg up to the deserving poor. And it's absolute rubbish. They're saving no money and making it almost impossible for people who are out of work to find it, or making it a lot more difficult anyway.
Martin, some claimants waited 8 months for their first payment on the switch to universal credit, which rolls 6 different benefits into one. The government claimed universal credit would bring £34 billion return over 10 years. I suppose that's 3.4 billion a year, roughly. But they're being told by the National Audit Office today, we are being told, that's complete nonsense. It said more people would get into work and stay there longer. And actually, they have absolutely no way of telling if more people have gone into work or if more people are either homeless, on the streets, simply not claiming, or possibly working for organised crime.
Well, I think that's good full marks to the National Audit Office for calling this out. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty obvious. And I think the real killer, as Fee says, is it's not saving any money. It's actually a vindictive social programme for the sake of having a vindictive social programme. If we wanted to save money, you could simplify the benefit system by making it easier to claim and so on. And I can't see that pushing people into homelessness is getting them jobs.
Even thinking about something as radical as a minimum income for everybody, minimum wage for everybody, so that the universal income, everybody gets a certain amount they can live on, whether they're working or not, and make it a decent level. I mean, you only have to wander around Broadmead at 5:30, and it's just awful. There's people bedding down.
You never used to see that either.
You saw one or two, but nothing like the levels.
Yeah, that's right.
It's just graphic, and it's appalling.
Well, where does the money come from? That's what we're always told by the Conservatives. I'm sorry, there is no money. Well, of course there is, and we discussed that right at the start of the programme. £100 billion tax lost annually because of the £30 trillion stashed in tax havens. Now, that £100 billion is not just for the UK, obviously, it's for the world. But that's a lot of money that could be going to help build infrastructure for the country, fill up potholes in roads, even maybe put new roads. Who knows?
Of doctors maybe might be nice. Yes. A couple of doctors, yeah. Nurses, that
train
kind of thing.
Doctors, train nurses, all sorts of things that money could be used for. Martin, let's get on now to what Steve Keane had to say. He said a crash, in order to prepare for a crash, there's three things. We'll run through them one by one. He said, first of all deposits should be unconditionally guaranteed. The notion that depositors are investing in their bank is nonsense.
Yeah, that's pretty much a principle established in the 1930s by the New Deal in the US. And that's right. Depositors should be protected, but shareholders should be cleaned out if the bank goes bust. Although, of course, what's happened with the sale of the tranche of RBS shares recently is that the taxpayer lost £2 billion on that, which means that the shareholders of RBS were given £2 billion by the taxpayer. Have they been looking for jobs, do you think, those people? Have they been sleeping on the street? That's where the money went. £2 billion to shareholders of RBS. Who should have been wiped out.
Well, talking of the shareholders, his second point is the shareholders and bondholders of the banks should be on the line first to back the depositors. If they lose everything, then tough. They're investing, and risks are part of that business.
Well, that's right. If you invest in the stock market or in anything, you get a dividend, and that dividend is to compensate you for the risk that you will lose your money. But what we've got here is a one-way system set up where those who are the investors in the stock market, the wealthy classes by definition, get a one-way bet where when shares are going up, they take all the profits, and when shares are going down, the government steps in and bails them out. That's the other thing that's happened. It's not just that we've got all the tax havens have got money in. The government, not just the British government, have stepped in and bailed out the asset-owning classes. If you're going to follow a free market policy, and Austrian school economists have said this, and I've got some sympathy for what they're saying, you let the banks collapse, which means that wealthy people lose all their money.
I mean, what you're saying is really that capitalism died in 2008. This isn't, whatever we have got now, it isn't capitalism.
No, it isn't. It isn't. The Austrian school economists are pretty clear about this. They call it central planning by central banks. I think that they don't understand central planning, but
Is it socialism for and by the super rich?
It's socialism for the wealthy, and that devil take the hindmost for everybody else, isn't it?
Yeah, point three Steve makes is that the banks should be nationalised with no recompense to shareholders or bondholders, pending restructuring and later resale, possibly. The bank staff bonuses must be frozen. Top management sacked. There has to be pain for failure. And I suppose what he's saying there is that never happened in 2008.
Well, that's exactly right. And, of course, the illusion is that somehow we've come through the crisis and we're out of the woods, but we're not, because we've basically kicked the can down the road for 8 to 10 years, and now we're coming to the end of that process.
What about this point about basic living income? Because there's a lot of economists say that this is an important part of all of this.
Well, I think that one of the reasons why universal credit was widely accepted across the political spectrum when Ian Duncan Smith first came up with the idea is because he'd basically taken that idea. Let's have one benefit. Now, I think there is a problem if you put people's housing and their other benefits. There's problems with housing. You've got to have a separate set of institutions to deal with housing. But I think the principle that everybody should be given a basic income and then they can earn on top of that, that really is an incentive to go out to work. Yep. I'm on universal credit at the moment. I'm working, but I still get a universal credit top up because I don't earn enough to pay the rent. But 63 pence of every pound I earn goes back to the government. And therefore, you know, beyond a certain point, it's certainly not in my interest to work.
It's certainly increasingly becoming an idea that economists are taking more and more seriously. And I think it was regarded as being an idealistic, hippie, pie-in-the-sky type thing. Yeah. But, you know, increasingly people say, actually, it works. The impact on the health system is enormous because people aren't depressed. It facilitates people re-entry into the workplace.
Well, we'll be talking about the Bilderbergers in part two, which is the super rich. This is the NATO zone super rich, one of the most powerful business lobby groups in the NATO countries, who I would imagine can afford a few £100 a week to help a few poor people, especially since they've got more money in their bank accounts than they could ever spend. Mm. So I would have thought a few bob might be going spare. But I thought we'd have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions. And I suppose this is really very much connected with all of this, which is the slow destruction, it seems, of the benefit system. And this is about poverty and and benefits on Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions.
Julie Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My constituent, Ian, has lifelong profound learning and physical disabilities. He's doubly incontinent, cannot wash, dress or cook for himself. He's no notion of personal safety and left unsupervised is at risk. He's able to live independently thanks to the support of his elderly mother, who is herself unwell, and by virtue of a local authority social care package. Now, Ian's PIP application that he needs to fund this care has been refused on the grounds that he can cope unaided. Does the Prime Minister agree with me? There is something very wrong with a system that punishes citizens whose only crime is to be born disabled. Will she agree to investigate on behalf of the thousands of vulnerable people who are being made to suffer?
Can I say to the Honourable Lady that obviously she's raised a specific case, and I'm sure she will understand I don't have the details to address that specific case, and I don't think it would be right to do so here in this chamber. What I can assure her and other members of the House are that individual cases that are raised with me in Prime Minister's Questions are taken extremely seriously, and this one will be no exception. So I will ensure that the case is looked at urgently by the relevant minister. Obviously, cases are complex, they are multifaceted, but the case will be looked at urgently.
Do you believe her fee?
I don't think question time's long enough for everyone to bring all their constituents' cases to Parliament where things have gone wrong. I mean, you may know I worked for an MP some time ago. That was a couple of years back, but even then, the assessments that people like Atos were making of people were unbelievably inaccurate and unbelievably harsh. We had people who clearly were in no fit state to go to the shops on their own, let alone go and find a job, and they were being assessed as being perfectly capable for work. And even things like doctor's evidence weren't taken into account. The Atos nurses would basically examine them, do a couple of what appeared to be fairly cursory tests, and the appeals, I mean, something like... When people had assistance from people like the Avon and Bristol Law Centre, the success rate of the appeals was phenomenally high because people were being assessed wrongly. There was somebody who came to us once who had lost a leg in a motorbike accident, was assessed on a certain level, 6 months later was reassessed and he's put on a different grading. And it's like, well, evidently his leg's still missing. Exactly the same. It was unbelievable. It was clearly punitive. It was clearly aimed at forcing people off benefits. And this business about, well, disabled people do better when they're in work. Well, everyone does better when they're in work, but you can't starve people into work or force people into work. You have to support them.
The sinister side to this is really the most vulnerable people, many of whom, of course, who are actually born disabled, are being told there's going to be no money for you. Now, that means no food, that means no transport. Yep. It means basically they're housebound and possibly even evicted.
Well, and people with mental health problems as well and other invisible disabilities really have a rough time of it, because quite often mental health issues, they come and go, they're up and down, they're not constant. And so it's very, very difficult to assess realistically. And there just aren't the resources there to assess people properly either.
Martin, why is it legal to take food away from a disabled person?
Well, I'd make two points about this. Why is it anybody other than qualified doctors deciding whether people are fit for work or not? What is this, the Burma Railway? And the second point I'd make is that employers don't want necessarily to employ these people. In communist Cuba, every enterprise has to have a number of disabled people on its staff, people with mental health issues. There's full employment in Cuba because it's a planned economy. But can you imagine private sector employers? They're not there. They're not there for the good of society. They're trying to make a profit, so they don't want to employ these people.
I think some of the more enlightened private ones. They recognise that diversity is a strength, not a weakness.
Well, indeed, but at the same time, there's no demand side to this.
Let me ask you the same question. Why, in any civilised country, is it legal to take food away from a disabled person?
I think they're fairly indiscriminate. They're happy to take food away from anyone, really, aren't they? I mean, when it comes to sanctioning people's benefits, there's equality for you. They're as happy to take benefits away from people who are disabled as able-bodied.
And what about, particularly for youngsters, they might be very, very tempted to say, well, actually, I can go and deal drugs now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's an awful lot of sort of under the radar economy going on increasingly, and also there's a large number of young people being out on the streets. Those young people you see out in Broadmead, and they're really if you're under 25, it's damn hard to find a place to live, basically, because even if you can get hold of housing benefit, trying to get a place in a shared house these days is phenomenally difficult. There's huge competition for it.
Have the Greens actually got their head around this, do you think? I don't think we're going to see a Green government in the next Parliament. But you lack faith, Tony. One of the things the Greens are very good at is actually introducing ideas that then take on a life of their own.
Well, that indeed, it was quite a few Labour Party ideas we look at and go, oh gosh, that was our idea 10 years ago. How lovely they've taken it up. However, the universal income is one a very strong Green policy, which is, if you look at it, it's threaded throughout all of our economic stuff.
Martin.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, the Labour Party needs to be pushed in the right direction by those who have got a more radical perspective. And I was going to say something else, but it's gradually... Anyway, I mean, if we just think of what will happen. If say there was a crash and everybody's panicking, if you say to people, we are going to look after you, it's going to be all right, that is actually a very strong statement, isn't it? And it helps to stabilise the situation. And... ultimately, that's probably what will have to happen, but I'm afraid the crash will have to come first.
Are you going
first.
To say that to the bank shareholders?
The bank shareholders have got to lose their money. We've just been saying that all evening.
I'm afraid it's not going to be all right, bank shareholders. But anyway, it's okay because the trains are running on time.
Nadine Dorries.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My constituents have been incredibly tolerant in the face of the fiasco that has followed their commuter journey following the reorganisation of the timetables. However, added to their misery is the fact that when trains do turn up, they are incredibly overcrowded. I have written to Govia three times and asked them, could they please conduct a risk assessment on the safety of my passengers, my constituents, who are their passengers, as they come into London? And three times Govia have refused to answer me. Could the Prime Minister please use her good offices to ensure that on overcrowded trains at the moment and those suffering because of the rail delays, that our passengers are safe?
Well, can I say to my honourable friend that she raises an important issue, and the experience that passengers for Govia, Thames, Link, but also Northern, have had as a result of the change in timetable and the way that was done is simply unacceptable. And it is important that they improve the services. They have plans in place. I think Govia, Thames, Link, for example, are introducing a new timetable that is better than the pre-May timetable, which will have 200 more planned journeys. But of course, passengers need to know, passengers want to feel that they're able to travel in trains that aren't too crowded. And certainly this is an issue that I'm sure that Govia Thames Link will be looking at very seriously. We are working, the Department of Transport is working with the company and Northern to ensure that we can provide the services that people deserve. They pay for a ticket, they book a ticket, they pay for a season ticket, they deserve to have a decent journey.
Well, they certainly deserve to be able to get to work and back. And the government has been talking to Govia Thames Link, because today the boss of Southern Rail parent company, Govia Thames Link, Charles Horton, has resigned. Now, this is really due to timetable changes fee, and that's apparently what's caused this. But at the root of it is that the companies have changed the timetables, but they didn't really seem to prepare the crews, the drivers and the guards, to actually be at the right place at the right time to actually drive those trains.
Yeah, it does strike me as being one of the most monumental cock-ups, really. And also, I think there was some, from what I've seen, there was some fairly clear feedback from passengers saying this isn't going to work, which they chose to ignore. So... yeah, I think it's incompetence rather than conspiracy on this one, to be perfectly honest. And you know,
what about the reasons for that, though? Because surely, I mean, these companies want to run the trains, don't they?
Yeah, and I imagine that the director or the chief executive or whatever was probably being paid a pretty penny for doing what he was doing.
I mean, at least
in fairness, he did actually go. I mean,
here's
a week or two later.
For you.
Oh, go on then.
What about if you just cancel the train and let everyone wait an hour for the next one? I mean, surely you're only then paying for one train, but the passengers have all got to their destination probably just before the hour where you have to pay compensation. But if it's a half hourly service, you could just take off every other train with no financial
effect. and save on the... I mean, I don't know what the regulations are around train companies, if I'm perfectly honest, but...
I think they can do what they want,
Oh, well, there we go. Then they can save on rolling stock as well, can't they? Ta-da, job done.
Martin, what do you make of this? Because it's mainly in the North West and in London that this has been causing so many headaches.
Well, I think what's interesting is that this has come to Parliament at all, because once you've privatised the rail industry, surely the market just sorts it all out. Why is the Prime Minister being brought into this? And that's because, in actual fact, the rail industry is vital infrastructure, and as opinion polls show, a majority have always wanted it back in public hands, as it is in countries like France, for example. You know, the benighted French with their nationalised railway, which of course they run large chunks of our railway because
the Labour Party's been talking about nationalising the railways,
yeah,
hasn't it?
If you go to pretty much any other European city, you're just slack-jawed with how brilliant the public transport system is. And that's, again, it's, you know, it's got an economic benefit, it's got a health benefit, all kinds of things. And anything that keeps people out of their cars is a damn good thing, and gets them to work in an efficient fashion is a damn good thing. And you... any other European country, you go there and it's smooth as clockwork. If, you know, if the bus is 5 minutes late, people are calling the police.
What about the Metro bus and First Bus's performance here?
Oh, God, Metro bus is a long... It's one of those things that I think success has... You know, failure has... Success has many fathers and failure only one. I think people have... This has been going on for, what, 15 years? Through a number of different administrations. So I think it's very hard to point the finger at any one person about the problems that have happened on a Metro bus, not all of which have been the administration's problem, to be perfectly honest. I mean, it's installed, it appears to be working. There's good feedback on it so far. There's just not very much of it yet, that's all.
We had a story in the Daily Telegraph, just I think it was the end of last year. First group investors, Martin, revolt over the appointment of the former Carillion finance chief to First Group.
Well, I mean, it's a sort of revolving door, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about, you know, failure must be punished, but obviously not in this case.
But the finance chief at Carillion is now on the board of First Group.
Well, am I surprised? No. These people just move around hoovering money up. They're essentially looting, as I said earlier. A lot of this is looting, because what you do is you sweat the assets and you try to make money out of it. Whereas, of course, a nationalised railway aims to not make a loss. But, of course, the you have to subsidise rail. You know what the most subsidised rail industry section is in Britain? It's the commuter trains into London, because they're only used twice a day. And if you were going to follow a free market policy, you'd close them all down, because they don't make money. They have to be subsidised. But if you've got to subsidise something, what's the point of having it in the private sector? You might as well run it as a public subsidised thing.
More than a fifth of First Group investors voted against the election of Richard Adam as an independent non-executive director, an embarrassing blow to the transport group. But of course, they appointed him anyway.
Richard, I'd love to have seen his references.
Richard Adam. Well, I mean, he just moved just before it all collapsed, didn't he?
Obviously a smart guy.
But not before
he's the one
profit,
we want.
Not before the profit warning. Mr. Adam was one of Carillion's top bosses, serving as finance director between 2007 and the end of 2016. So the 10-year run-up to the collapse of Carillion, this guy was the finance director. It just seems amazing that these people are actually still walking the streets after so much public money has been poured down the drain. Also, let's have a listen now also to another clip from Prime Minister's Questions. This time it's about Donald Trump and the amazing successor, supposedly, over in North Korea. Actually in Singapore, wasn't it? But also about Brexit, Jeremy Corbyn decided to ask about.
Mr. Speaker, as the Prime Minister pointed out, tomorrow marks 1 year on the anniversary of the Grenfell Tower fire. I'll be meeting families again tomorrow at their silent march. But the sad truth and reality is that many of them are still waiting for the security of a permanent home 1 year on from that disaster. Mr. Speaker, when the Prime Minister met President Donald Trump last week, did she do as the Foreign Secretary suggested and ask him to take over the Brexit negotiations? I'll just have to add, Mr. Davis, you're a senior and supposedly cerebral member of the House. Well, in a leap year anyway. You
must attempt to recover your composure, man. I'm worried about you, and I'm worried for you. The Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On the Brexit negotiations, I might remind the Honourable Gentleman, right Honourable Gentleman, that before December, Labour cast doubt on whether we would get a joint report agreed. We did. Before March, he cast doubt on whether we'd get an implementation period, and we did. But I wanted, Mr. Speaker, if I may, just to respond to the comment that the Right Honourable Gentleman made about the very important subject of providing those who were the victims of the Grenfell Tower fire with permanent homes. Just so that I can make clear to the House, 203 households were in need of a new home. Every household has received an offer of temporary or permanent accommodation. 183 have accepted an offer of a permanent home. But I just wanted to say this, because it isn't just about the buildings. It's not just about the bricks and mortar of a home. People who suffered that night are having to rebuild their lives. Many of them lost somebody, members of their families, with whom they had been living and making a home for years. They lost all their possessions. They lost their mementos. They lost anything that reminds them of the person they loved. When they move into that new home, they will be restarting their lives. And I wanted to pay tribute to all the victims of the Grenfell Tower fire for the strength and dignity that they have shown.
That was three questions Jeremy Corbyn managed to roll into one there. One about Grenfell Tower, the first anniversary of that, and also about Donald Trump, and then number three, Brexit. Do you want to take them one by one, Fee?
Oh, blimey.
Start with Grenfell Tower, because it's a year on, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, where to start? I mean, it was always going to be difficult rehousing somewhere in a place like Kensington and Chelsea, isn't it? Sorry, I'm not very familiar with the London boroughs. But you know, it shouldn't have happened in the first place. It seems to be confusing. I mean, I don't know what the outcome of the inquiry is going to be, frankly, but I think it's certainly shaken a lot of people up, and perhaps rightly so, if anything good comes out of the whole ghastly episode.
Well, talking to some of the locals in Portobello, they talk about it as the atrocity, not as a disaster, because people were warning about it for months.
They were demonised, and they were shut out, and that, you know, again, I can't imagine that's the only place where that's happening, where people in buildings are being dismissed, their opinions are being dismissed because they're seen as being troublemakers, or they're vulnerable, or English isn't their first language, or all that kind of thing. So if anything, as I said, if anything good does come out of this whole ghastly episode, then hopefully it's that people are listened to just a little bit more, because they might have a point.
Do you think there were criminal offences committed? Do you think people should be arrested, jailed, that sort of thing?
Oh, God, I don't know. Whether people should be held accountable is one thing, and that's one of those kind of weasel phrases. I don't know whether there's criminal charges that can be made, but certainly, I think there was a lot of cultural issues going on there, in a culture of people ignoring the tenants because they regarded them as being beneath contempt, or you know, basically poor, or what have you. They were ignored, and I don't know whether you can actually arrest or charge people for that, but I think it should shake up people's attitudes towards their tenants.
But I mean, surely if you're putting flammable cladding on the outside of a building, and it's your decision to use flammable cladding on the outside of a building, is a bit of a no-brainer. That
you would have thought so, but who am I to second guess the outcome of the inquiry that goes into that?
Some have said there shouldn't be such a thing as flammable cladding.
Well, it makes sense, wouldn't it? I mean, cladding, yes, because it's got great insulating properties, and you know, we need to insulate our buildings and all the rest of it, but it does, I mean, as a layman, it would appear that somebody cocked up quite badly there.
At a certain point, you've got to make a decision, haven't you? Do you use flammable cladding, or do you pay a bit more?
You wouldn't believe that such a thing exists, though, would you, really? I mean, really? I'm sorry, I'm not going to laugh, but it does seem ridiculous.
What do you make of this whole business of whether it's a crime has been committed, and whether we should have trials as well as an inquiry?
Well, I would be of the opinion that the police should have actually started prosecutions. Inquiries in Britain tend to be whitewashes. They always did tend to be whitewashes.
A lot of people in Portobello have been talking about Hillsborough, for example.
Yeah,
they?
Yeah, and of course, you know,
20 years, didn't it?
Yeah, and there's been a change in British legislation concerning inquiries a few years ago. I think it's 2009, which means that the executive have full control. Inquiries used to be handed to the judiciary, but now the executive can control control what's said and in who, you know, what the scope is. And the Pat Finucane Centre in Northern Ireland have always called for an inquiry into collusion between the security forces and the loyalist paramilitaries, which have ended up in hundreds of deaths. But they don't want a British inquiry, they want an international inquiry. And that's because British inquiries are historically whitewashes.
I suppose the reason why I feel slightly uneasy about prosecuting people is that there's a real danger of scapegoating an individual, when in fact it appears it's a much broader cultural problem than that. And yes, having clear punishments for people can have a deterrent effect on future housing associations or whatever, and deter them from ignoring people. But there is that whole scapegoating thing, and it appears clear to me that there was a number of people involved in those decisions.
Well, I think Fielding Mellon, who made that, I mean, the decision, it seems to me,
Rock Fielding Mellon,
the decision to put cladding on the building, it was designed in the 1970s, and in the 1970s it was just a concrete block, and that's why the fire brigade had the thing of stay in your rooms, because they're designed to, there's a fire in one part, it won't spread. And then Fielding Mellon decided to put cladding on for good reasons. You know, if you like, we've got to create more green technology and so on. But it was also for cosmetic reasons, to keep the house prices of the people who live nearby in owner-occupied properties. They didn't like looking at concrete. And the people who made the flammable cladding said that it shouldn't be used on any building over three stories. That's what it said on the kit. Now, I would suggest that Rock Fielding Mellon should have had his collar felt. And, of course, this inquiry is, in a way of getting... I mean, it's the same with the soldiers on Bloody Sunday. You know, maybe they should have been arrested and prosecuted, never mind having an inquiry.
What about point number two, I suppose? This is Trump, and we don't normally talk about international stuff in the first hour, but, Fee, what do you make of this thing in North Korea? Do you think... Because some people are saying, well, Trump has had an amazing success. Do you think he has, or is it all just...
I think it's so hard to look through... Well, it's so hard to look through the sways of hype and smoke and mirrors that... I'm just with Robert De Niro on this one, quite frankly. I don't know if you've seen that clip, but yeah.
Which is what?
I can't use language I couldn't possibly repeat on a community radio station.
Martin, help us out here.
Well, if we talk about Robert De Niro, he was bad-mouthing Trump in a rather, you know...
Graphic
okay. way. But, I mean, in the general situation, I think we should be guardedly optimistic about this. It's not necessarily, you know, we're not out of the woods yet. But because Trump is such a kind of loose cannon, he's basically overruled the more hawkish advice he's been getting, because he wants, you know, he likes the publicity. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why the deep state don't like him, because he's not reliable, from their point of view.
He turns on a penny from day to day. So,
that's right.
Well, no, he just does 180 degrees, so goodness knows what will come out.
Yeah, exactly.
He might have fallen out.
So it makes it
very, very hard. I mean, I get your guarded optimism, but it's damn guarded, because you simply don't know what's going to happen next.
Would the EU negotiators have met their match if he was in charge of negotiating from the British point of view with the European Union?
Well, the thing about the EU negotiators is that, you know, the British people don't seem to have, or the British government don't have any cards. They've got no bargaining chips. They've got nothing. So Europe is going to turn around and go, I don't think so. So,
surely the Europeans want... us to trade with them, don't they? Sure, that's at least something that's a bargaining chip.
Yeah, they've got plenty of other trading partners and they've got each other. So I think we've got an incredibly weak bargaining position. And also, I mean, simply unravelling all of the EU legislation that's going to have to be unravelled in the UK. It's taking up every single lawyer in the UK, and we're bringing people in from New Zealand, apparently. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And also, we can go on to this later, I suppose, but the impacts on people, I mean, especially on women. I was at a symposium the other week, get me, where they were discussing the very real issues that are going to occur because of, you know, benefits to things like equal pay, which is tied up in EU legislation, holidays, which is tied up in EU legislation, all kinds of things which benefit women. And they're going to be swept away. And they might be replaced, they might not. There's all sorts of things.
What about food and environmental standards? Because that looks like that's going out the window,
too. Quite possibly, yes. And that's just it, because I think... The administration is blundering around, you know, from crisis to crisis around Brexit, and they're just sort of patching things up. So who knows? It doesn't look too great, though.
But Britain is not the only country in Europe that's having second thoughts about Brussels. We've got the Greeks, we've got the Catalonians and the Spanish, we've also got the Italians. They had an election in March where they voted for these two quite extreme parties, actually, on the right and the left, that were both anti-Brexit. So
they're not anti-Brexit.
Sorry, so both anti-Brussels.
They couldn't give much for monkeys about Brexit, I would imagine.
No, that's right. It's the thing about Brexit is most people don't care. Mm. They care about Italy. Mm. They've got their own problems.
All I'm saying is that Brussels has got a lot of problems. There's a lot of people that have had enough, and they've decided they don't want this club anymore.
Yeah, but we are going to, if we don't look towards Europe, we're going to be looking towards America, and that way madness lies, quite frankly.
Certainly at the moment, it seems that way.
Well, I mean, let's come back to the original point, which was that Boris Johnson was bugged, supposedly, making this speech. In actual fact, most people think he engineered it. And he's saying if Trump was in charge, and who looks like Trump in British politics, then it would all be going well, because he would go in there and he'd bang his fist on the table, and all these Eurocrats would just crumble. And as Fee just pointed out, the Europeans just approach this, and of course it's the Irish that they've got to negotiate with. The British ruling class don't really understand this. This is the Irish question, the thing that Gladstone could never solve, and he thinks he's solved he'd answered the question, and then the Irish changed the question, as Sarah and Yeatman famously said in the 30s. This is about the Irish question, and they think it's not. It's taken ages to work this out. No, this is the Irish have got a veto, and they've got their sovereignty as well, and they had to fight 800 years for it. They understand sovereignty. Is Boris Johnson ready to starve himself to death in prison for sovereignty?
We hear this week that the Bristol Arena project cost is going to rise to £156 million. I'm not sure which arena that is. Is that the one up in Filton, or is that the one at Templemeads?
Well, now let's think. There's a lot of things in that report. The number one thing that comes out of that report is that it says the Arena Island site by Templemeads is a viable site and should bring in profits for the City Council in a certain period of time. However, the Brabazon site, talk about a back of a fag packet. There's very few costs involved. YTL are interested in doing it because I think they think they're going to get some transport infrastructure money, which they need up there. I mean, I don't know there's so much which is missing or wrong in that report. There's no social impact in the report. There's no environmental impact element of that report. But what is clear is that it could work at Temple. It will work at Arena Island, but we've got no idea about the Brabazon site. And also, just thinking about it, I mean, there's all kinds of spurious arguments put forward about, well, you know, it'll be easier to access from Wales to get to Brabazon. Has anybody ever tried to go on the M5 on a Friday evening? How on earth are you going to get anybody into the Filton site on a Friday evening unless you're going to chop them in for the next 10 years? It's so much which is missing from that report, and so much that is wrong. And even KPMG, who wrote it, if you look at it, throughout it's peppered with, well, we're working on information given to us by YTL. We're working on information given to us by Bristol City Council. They are distancing themselves very clearly from the conclusions that are made.
I mean, isn't this just an attempt so that they can kind of muddy the water so the arena at Templemeads doesn't get built?
I think if it doesn't get built at Templemeads, not going to get built anywhere, to be perfectly honest. But I mean, one of the fundamental things about the Brabazon site, the Filton site, is that it does say, well, at any point YTL could pull out and say it's not going to make enough money for us, and at no point does it say how much money that amount of money is, so they could just drop out whenever they fancy
This sounds a little bit like HS2 or Hinkley C, you know, one of these massive wonderful projects that everyone's talking about for years and years. Will it ever happen?
I don't know. I really don't know. I'd love to see it happen at Templemeads because it would boost the south of the city. It would boost the city centre. I mean, just looking at the way it works in places like Cardiff, yes, the costs have gone up, but we've got absolutely no idea how much it's going to cost in Filton. It's total back of the fag packet thing.
£33 million less in Filton it will cost.
Yeah, well, I'd love to see the workings on that one, quite frankly, because they are so iffy, and the transport infrastructure required around there beggars belief. Not to mention, as I said, the social environmental impacts. I mean, one of the things about the Temple Arena site was that it was going to benefit South Bristol. It was going to bring a huge amount of trade into the city centre, which God knows it needs it. Something out in Filton, it's going to suck more trade, more business away towards Cribbs Causeway. It's an absolute disaster.
Martin, what do you think here? Because we've got two... I mean, I know you don't take any great excited interest in the arena, but you've got two possible sites.
I'm not likely going much myself, I have to say.
You've got two sites here. One is right in the middle of the city. The other one is right on the periphery. I mean, it just seems to be a no-brainer. Why have it on the periphery of the city? It's like an out-of-town shopping centre.
Well, I take that on board. I presume the argument is that it's cheaper to do it there and that the private sector thinks they can make a go of it. But, I mean, what use is that to Bristol, really? I mean, why should Bristol City Council underpin what is essentially a private... Like, Cribbs Causeway has destroyed the city centre of Bristol.
And show me a city arena site that hasn't had some public money in it. They all have public money in it. They don't make a... No, none of them have been set up by private companies and made a profit.
Well, I would...
Because city councils... No, they recognise the benefit it brings to city centres and the employment.
Well, I mean, I'm to be honest with you, I'm not that keen on having an arena
at
all.
Yeah, I'm not wedded to it either.
I think if it yeah. collapses, it won't be the end of the world, because you don't want to compete with Cardiff. There's one in Cardiff which you can get on the train and go to, and you know, why would the Bristol one attract? What it might do is they both share. You know, they cut the takings in Cardiff, and they don't take enough in Bristol. They make them both unviable.
If you look at the proposals for the alternative uses of the Temple Arena site or the Arena Island, it's to put a conference centre there. Now, I bet Bristol Sport are absolutely delighted about that, because they've got their shiny conference centre there. Newport have just opened up a conference centre, you know, half an hour down the M4. So it's not as there's been no competition for a conference site on Arena Island either. It's just not been thought through at all. I get the impression that the rather well-paid executive director in charge of this has, you know, just come up with a bunch of harebrained ideas. He's being paid handsomely for this, you know, the chap in charge of this for the council.
I mean, is this actually something that the council has led on? Because it seems to me that there's a sort of business elite community around the southwest that are trying to sort of push this, and what they're doing is they're looking for our council tax money and central government money to part fund it.
Well, I think the point about the Brabazon site is it would require less council funding. However, in my personal opinion, I think this whole project, the looking at the Brabazon site, is actually fueled by pure spite, because Marvin doesn't like the idea of something which had George Ferguson's name all over it being built in the city centre. That's why it's delayed for a couple of years. Nothing's going to get built in this administration. I doubt even a decision will be made over the next 2 years. So that's what I think has motivated it, rather than big business in this particular instance, though they're happy to snap it up.
So it's a sort of diversion, really, as an excuse for not making a decision.
Yeah, and it's being portrayed as being, I'm saving the citizens of Bristol loads of money. Well, actually, not really, because the calculations are so poor, they're so narrow. As I said, there's no environmental or social impact report in any of this stuff. It's very thin. It's very, very thin, and it's an absolute disgrace that it's taken so long to faff around for this long. We just need to get on with it and build the damn thing. If you want to build an arena at all, and as you know, as you were saying, I'm not wedded to the idea of an arena. If we are going to build one, let's stick it on Arena Island.
Another story this week. It's the man who discovered he was fathered by an undercover policeman. He reveals he supports Lush's controversial Spy Cops ad campaign. The unnamed man was a core participant in an inquiry into undercover police tactics, which now the core participants have walked out of because the police are refusing to give them names of the these Spy Cops. He praised Lush, which put photos of officers with paid to lie in shop windows. He said his mother was duped into a relationship with an officer who posed as an animal rights activist. This was in the Daily Mail this week. Martin, one of the most frightening things about this is actually these police were spying on groups who, although they might at some point in the future have committed an offence, are actually not breaking the law at all. I mean, surely the idea of undercover police is they go in to infiltrate organised crime and gangs who are committing crime, not people who are environmental protesters.
Well, indeed. I mean, I don't know if people have seen the film Other People's Lives, which is about the life in East Germany before the fall of the wall. And this is actually, you know, people think Britain isn't like East Germany. It is. You've got hundreds, literally hundreds of undercover cops who've been targeting the environmental movement in particular. And that's because the environmental movement is seen as a particular threat to corporate interests. And, you know, of course, there's loads of people been blacklisted in the building industry and so on. This isn't a free society. It never has been.
Lush has sparked outrage, apparently, when it launched what critics called a crass and insensitive anti-police hate campaign. The company said it was supporting the Police Spies Out of Lives campaign for women tricked into sleeping with undercover officers who infiltrated anti-capitalist and green protest groups over 40 years. Lush has now removed the posters, citing intimidation of staff by former police officers. So that's NAPO, probably, National Association of retired police officers, I think they're called. The sign said paid to lie, with half the person's face as an undercover officer, another one with an officer with a helmet on, and tape across the windows of the Lush shop saying police have crossed the line.
I think I mean, I work with local police officers a lot, and I've worked with the police in the past, and many of them are fine, upstanding people. However, I think there is a culture that they and they alone occupy the moral high ground, and they don't. Sometimes they get it wrong, and they do not have the unswerving, unthinking loyalty and admiration they perhaps think they have in the wider society.
Why has there been so little fallout from this? Infiltrating groups that aren't even breaking the law?
But what interests me is the fact that the police think it's okay to target Lush and to have a go at them about it. As though, I mean, no, they're not beyond criticism.
NAPO, keep your eye on them. They're quite a nasty little pressure group. Anyway, time for the Murdoch News at 7 now, thanks to our guest, Green Councillor for Redland.
Thank you.
Fee Hance, join us after the news. We do our best to keep ahead of the curve.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.